Good afternoon. My name is Holly Glover, and I'm here to introduce the speakers for this session. We're very privileged to have Dr. Mark Sirota. He's triple board certified in dermatology, allergy, asthma, immunology, and pediatrics. He's in private practice in Denver. He has published numerous textbook chapters, online reference articles, and peer-reviewed articles in the areas of dermatologic and allergic diseases. We also have Mr. Gallo. He's a healthcare attorney, serving physicians, PAs, and other providers for many years. He defends licenses before various government agencies and represents providers against hospitals and nursing homes, as well as against insurance companies. He also has extensive experience in medicine as a provider, administrator, and educator. Please welcome Dr. Sirota and Tom Gallo.
All right, thanks everyone. Thanks for joining the session today. So I'm Mark, this is Tom.
Hello. I'm the guy with the New York accent, by the way, so if you need an interpreter, please ask around.
I also grew up in New York, but I moved to the Midwest when I was 17, so I like slowly got it beaten out of me in Kansas City. But I think for all the science lectures and all the deep dives that you're doing into treatments and procedures and everything else that's going on at this meeting, in my opinion, this might be the most important topic of a medical meeting because this is something that invokes a lot of fear into providers and really affects the way in which we practice.
I'll second that, absolutely.
So this topic is usually something that evokes a lot of anxiety as well, and our goal today is not to have you walk out being scared of getting sued or really alter the way in which you're practicing, but more to what I think hone a little red light in the back of your mind. So when you have an issue or something come up, you have that little light that goes off in the back of your mind that says, I need to push pause, I need to slow down, hopefully take away some of the pearls and the highlights from this talk so that you can essentially cut off a problem before it actually becomes a problem. So we're really here to give you like a superpower. We're not here to make you anxious or nervous about getting sued. That is not the goal of this talk. So Tom, do you want to give your disclosures here?
You can go to the next slide. I have nothing to disclose.
Okay. So I think it goes without saying why Tom is here. He's an attorney. He's also a physician assistant who's worked in multiple different areas of medicine, like more than I could even count when I was asking him, oh, what kind of PA? He's like, yes, to all of them. So he is eminently qualified. I think the reason I'm qualified to talk about this is I work as a medical expert witness. I've been deposed over 20 times. I've testified in court 10 plus times. So I represent us as a specialty, so I get to see the reasons why people sue dermatology practitioners, and I've had that curtain pulled back, and it turns out it's not always the reasons that you think. In fact, a lot of the times, it's not the reasons you think, and there's a few simple things that we can do to help prevent a lot of these issues from coming up.
All right, so what are our objectives today? It's always nice to know, right? We're gonna define medical malpractice, look at some of the risks in various clinical settings, discuss the protections afforded by law and how to utilize such protections. And we're going to discuss some of the sequelae. You like that medical word mixed in with the legal thing? But the sequelae that I'm concerned about is license investigations. We're going to talk about that a little bit as well. Some other concerns and anything else that arises, we're going to leave some time at the end for your questions.
So again, my disclaimers, no one likes to think about getting sued. It's not designed to evoke fear, and the goal is to hone a little red light. If you leave this room after we discuss everything and maybe go over a few case examples, and you kind of, when you hear about a case, you can kind of pinpoint the areas that you could have, things could have been done differently, then I feel like that was my goal, and that I did my job to have you walk out with some actionable things that you can take back with you to your practice.
Absolutely, and I like to think of it as preventative medicine. I do preventative law. What does that do? It chases away business, it chases away money, but it also, it's better for you, and that's okay for me. We want our patients to live longer. We want to do annual exams or something like that on a frequent basis. I also want you to avoid trouble. So while this is a scary subject matter, please don't, that's not the design. It's not designed to scare you. It's designed to help you and get you thinking a little bit, and I love that little red light thing. That's Dr. Sirota's little red light. I think it's good. So anyway, that being said, what makes something something, right? When we learn about medical topics, we learn about the different diagnostic criteria that have to be there. Well, in law, they call them elements of a case. So a medical malpractice lawsuit against a physician, a PA, an NP, or any other, you know, person that's providing medical care consists of four different things. The first is duty. Duty means that you have an obligation to care for that patient, right? So do any of you have a duty to treat me? No, not unless you become my provider, right? So if you give me advice, no big deal, right? Obviously, we'd be all very good advice, so I'm not worried about that. But there's duty, and then a breach of that duty becomes, you know, the second element of the case construction, right? So if I have a, I'll use myself as an example because I'm not superstitious, number one, and number two, I don't want you to get nervous, but if I'm taking care of a patient, they're my patient, right? And I still see patients occasionally, but it's all volunteer and doesn't matter. But breaching that obligation to take care of that patient would involve my duty is there to take care of that patient, but I don't do it. I don't live up to that standard of care. I'm not taking care of the patient, so as a result of that, I'm breaching my duty, D-U-T-Y. Damages is the amount of harm that happens to a patient as a result, and that's usually defined in money terms, right? You can't give back a life if a patient dies, so you give money instead. That's the good old American way. Right? Damages is what the person's life, based upon actuarial tables and other similar cases and things like that, define that life or that injury as being worth. The one I skipped was causation. And causation is a legal term that means something caused something else to happen. And it's referring to the breach of duty, right? So I have a duty to take care of a patient. I breach that duty by not, reaching or maintaining a level of care that is sufficient to meet the standard of care. It causes harm to a patient and harm of a significant nature that can be sued for and all those different things. So if you don't have those four elements, you don't have a medical malpractice case. You might have something different, but you won't have a medical malpractice case. And not to beat it to death, but if there's no harm to a patient, doesn't matter that you were wrong, doesn't matter that you were late, that you were, you know, did something inappropriate in terms of your treatment, there's no malpractice case. That's a great thing. It could be other things, and we'll talk a little bit about that, but you got to have all four elements: duty, breach, causation, and damages. I'm speaking on a general national level. Each state has, you know, slight specifics that could vary from state to state, but that's pretty much it.
I heard you say the standard of care as well, which is a yes. term that has a people ascribe a lot of things to that term. Mm-hmm. At least when I'm writing medical reports in most states, the definition of the standard of care, some people think it's like, oh, it's what the AAD guidelines say how you're supposed to treat it, or it's, you know, a certain article that's authoritative. Or no, the definition of standard of care, and correct me if I'm wrong, Tom, is what would the average practitioner with the same level of training in your locale have done with that patient, and did you grossly deviate from what that average practitioner with that level of training would have done in your locale? Okay, so that is the definition of standard of care. It's not guidelines are just that, they're guidelines, right? Articles are certain articles. The standard of care is an expert like me is gonna come and say an average dermatologist or an average derm PA in New York City would have treated them this way, and they did something that grossly deviated from that. That's the standard of care.
Right. And did you all catch that? That was a lot of words, but it's common sense in a way, but it's not necessarily universally known. The only thing that I would maybe add to that would be under similar circumstances, right? I'm a lawyer. I always got to parse things a little bit, right? But the reason I say that is you can use that in your defense. Again, what happened in the last few years? I don't know, this pandemic thing happened, right? And it changed the way a lot of things were done. So what a dermatologist or a derm PANP would do under typical circumstances was changed. You had some technology, which is not something we always had, but you're gonna have to use that. And again, what happened with the malpractice laws during that time period varied from state to state as well. New York did something very interesting. And maybe your states did as well. But we're good with that? Good, thank you. Actually, did we do that? Will, could you go back one slide, please? Thank you. All right, so we were talking about duty, existing duty and so on. Who's our patient? Again, our patient is somebody, when we have a medical record, electronic or otherwise, we know who our patient is, right? They know who their provider is, usually. Sometimes things can happen that would change that. You came in casual contact with them, maybe as part of a group or something like that, you are now covering that patient and you don't even know it because you're on call that night, they called, something happened or whatever, now you're embroiled in this thing or whatever. So lots of different things can affect the whether or not you have a duty to that patient. One of the things that come up is negligence and gross negligence. As Mark said, not meeting the standard of care, that's negligence. Gross negligence is something that much more severe, right? The example I always like to use, I'm kind of standing here right by the microphone because the microphone is here. Normally I have the lavalier. But anyway, one of the examples I use of gross negligence is doing CPR with your foot. I'm doing this over on this side, right? So doing CPR with your foot. Is that normal? No, that's crazy to do that, right? But if you had your arms blown off and that's all you could do when you're using your foot to do CPR, maybe it's not gross negligence. Maybe it's not even negligence. Maybe it's heroic. It's wonderful. So you got to look at all these circumstances together. But when we're talking about negligence and gross negligence, it does help to know what those terms mean. But again, it can mean something different under slightly different circumstances, and you can get carried away with that. But negligence is simply not meeting the standard, and gross negligence is way more. Good? Next. Again, we talked about damages and causation. Next slide, please.
There's various different complaint types, and I think it's helpful to understand the three basic types. So one is a civil complaint, which is they're looking for money damages. They think that you wronged them, you deviated from the standard of care, and you committed malpractice, and they're suing you civilly for monetary damages. Now, one thing I always think I try to dispel, especially when there's an attorney on stage with me, is people think there's an attorney that'll just take any case. Like, doesn't matter the merits or not, there's some attorney out there that's going to take it. But one thing that I think protects against that is the idea of a contingency. If Tom's going to take a malpractice case,
which he doesn't
because he represents us, but if he was going to, he wouldn't take a meritless case because he has to lay out all the money for that case. Like, he has to pay me as an expert and all these different fees. And if there's no merit there and he's going to lose, he's going to take a bath taking that case. So the fact that there's contingencies is actually designed to protect against meritless cases. And most expert witnesses will not even be an expert witness for somebody that is representing themselves pro se because they haven't jumped over that bar to say an attorney is willing to put their money where their mouth is and take the case. So that's why I think contingency is not necessarily a bad thing. It actually can protect you against meritless claims. The second type is medical board complaints, which in a lot of ways actually scares me more than a civil complaint does. And then the third is a criminal complaint, which would scare me the most, but most of you are not going to be engaged in a criminal complaint. But the two main types of complaints would either be a malpractice claim or a medical board complaint. And my father, who's an attorney, he's been an attorney for like 50 years, he was a prosecutor, he's a criminal and civil defense attorney now, he always says, do you want to be practical or do you want to be right? Being right always costs more. Okay, let me show you what I mean. Here's a thought experiment. So there's no right answer to this question. I will love to hear what Tom says about it, but a patient feels you caused them harm because you created hyperpigmentation on their back. They signed a written consent form saying they could cause hyperpigmentation scarring. You documented 2 freeze thaw cycle, a reasonable amount of time, 8 seconds for an inflamed SK. You note in your mind, this is an expected side effect. The patient signed the consent form. It's on their back. It's not even on their face. Why are they bothering me? I did nothing wrong. The patient's attorney has not filed a lawsuit yet and is asking for $3,000 to settle the matter. So do you privately settle with your own attorney for $3,000 even though you know that they have no case, refuse to settle the matter, or contact your malpractice insurance and get them involved and let them handle it? So raise your hand if you would privately settle the matter with your own attorney. Nobody. How many people would refuse to settle and say, get out of here, do what you want to do, I didn't do anything wrong? And how many of you would contact your mouth? A few.
So by definition, everybody was going to vote for the next one?
Everybody wants contact malpractice? Tom, what would you do?
Well.
Or you don't know?
Well, what would I do? I wouldn't decide it here and now for sure, but I think under the, it raises a great point, and this is a real thing, right? Can you, some of you relate to this? This kind of thing happens. Most of the time, the plaintiff's attorneys for malpractice cases, they wouldn't pull something like this, not for $3,000, but you never know, it could happen. I see that more in dental cases, podiatry cases, and stuff like that. Usually not so much with the medical
cases. Well, let's just say it was the patient, not that they didn't get their attorney involved yet.
But if they're asking for money, you got to think of what the consequences are going to be. As Mark mentioned, you got three things that we're looking at, right? We're looking at a civil lawsuit, which is just money, other people's money, your insurance company. Who cares, right? You're looking at your license potentially being investigated. That's a big thing. That's what you invested. You built your whole life around, right? That's your money-making machine for the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And then, you know, the possibility of wearing an orange jumpsuit, having a criminal conviction and issues like that, that's really scary, right? So liberty, you know, before other things, but certainly money is not nearly as important as your professional career and your license and so on. So I think with something like that, you want to protect all these things. So with this particular scenario, you don't want to put anything in jeopardy, but, you know, what's the gut reaction on something like that? I have a certain personality that I would make a gesture, but I'm in polite company right now, so I can't do that. I'd say, you know, file a lawsuit. File a lawsuit. Because things are going to happen as a result of that. You're going to set a precedent. Other people are going to hear. This lawyer is going to have other patients or whatever. Did Dr. Sirota hurt you? You're going to see that on the buses and stuff like that. Right? Crazy. No offense. The other Sirota is spelled differently. and so on. So I think you really got to be careful with settling that. There are advantages, too. And sometimes if you see a really strong case, you say, maybe we can work something out. Why don't you stop by the office? But I could go on for an hour about this.
And the idea for me, there's no right or wrong answer, but it's practical versus right. And it's not always at this step in the process. It could be get the patient back in immediately because I know they're upset and thinking about it from a practical perspective versus just trying to be right. So, and let's say instead of $3,000, they just wanted a dollar and an apology or something, right? Like you can make it an extreme example. Practical means you lose $3,000. Maybe the patient signs a non-disclosure and non-disparagement so they can't tell everyone what a terrible doctor Dr. Sirota is, and I move on with my life and I lost a, you know, Chanel bag. Being right, because I'm right, I'm telling you you're right, like you didn't do anything wrong. Being right means the patient could sue you, you could lose $20,000 to $100,000 in legal fees, maybe your malpractice gets involved and pays that, but then they may mess with your premiums and your coverage. The patient is free to write negative reviews all over town and actually do some of the stuff you just said. Maybe you lose money to defend a board complaint. So that patient can file a board complaint for any reason or no reason, and a board will be mandated to investigate you. And even if they find you did nothing wrong with that procedure, they might find other things that you did wrong in the medical record and end up censuring you in some way. And all of that could have been avoided if you paid the $500 or $3,000. So I'm not saying that you have to do it. And obviously, there are situations where you may not want to do it. I'm just saying, think about practical versus right. I acknowledge you're right, but what is actually practical here? Maybe they just want a dollar and an apology. Is that practical, or do you just still want to be right, right?
Right.
So it's practical versus right.
All right, so one of the things that happens when a medical malpractice payment is made on your behalf by an insurance company, it gets reported to, well, more than one entity. It goes to the National Practitioner Data Bank. Have you heard of that, NPDB? Anybody? You should hear about that. You should know about that. You're all on it. You ever hear that it's going to go on your permanent record? This is that permanent record. It's a federal permanent record where you have information stored about you that, this is not public information, but it is visible by the insurance companies, the licensing boards in the different states, and it's also visible to you. You could do a self-query on that, but you can see different things on it. You'll see criminal convictions, not that any of you would have that, malpractice payments, license board actions such as censure and reprimand, suspensions and revocations and things like that. So all that information goes on there. So the National Practitioner Data Bank has all that information. If you settle a case, as Mark said, that doesn't get reported if you pay it on your own. So it is, you know, a strategy that you may want to look at. And back to that point, honestly, which are you going to have least regrets about? And you don't know that sometimes until you go into the future. It's all 20/20 hindsight, right? But with something like this, you want to look at it and say, gee, whatever. And that's why it really helps to have somebody who's experienced in these things and giving you good advice, unlike certain cases where I've seen people get some not such good advice.
And if you're hiring someone, you should make them run this. It costs $5, and they have to run it, and they deliver the report to you. So I run a telemedicine company. Before I hire anybody, I tell them you have to pay the $5 and send me the report. And there's people I haven't hired because once I saw the report, it was like, oh, what happened over here? Because it's all on there.
The rate went down. It's down to $3.50.
Oh, sorry.
Believe it or not. No, it keeps going up. And I don't know why. I've never seen anything so crazy as that. And you could do it on yourself. It's like you would do a credit report on yourself before you applied for a mortgage. So you can definitely do that. You're not going to get too many surprises, but you never know. So could you go back one slide, Will? Okay. You can go forward again. Thanks. The legal consent on that last slide refers to, you need to know what's happening, right? When you settle a malpractice lawsuit, whether it's for $100,000, $1.7 million, or $28,000, or any other random number that you can think of, it goes to the National Practitioner Data Bank, it gets reported to the licensing board in your state, most likely. I can't tell you every state, but many states it does. So then that may trigger an investigation. New York State has 48 different definitions of misconduct, professional misconduct. So if you have something like negligence, that fits one of the definitions. Negligence on more than one occasion, gross negligence, incompetence, and all those different things. So if you settle a lawsuit that's an admission of negligence or finding negligence in a lawsuit that goes to trial, so you have a lot of things to think about, but your attorney should be telling you that, hey, there's going to be consequences. There's going to be sequelae to just settle in this case. You don't settle it and walk away. And I can tell you 100 stories about people that did that before they got to me, and I couldn't help them except defend their licenses or other things. So you want to watch that. But as Mark mentioned, everything that's reported to the state has to get investigated by the state licensing board. It's like Child Protective Services. It doesn't matter how ridiculous it is, they got to look into it. And they might find what was reported to them, or it might be something entirely different, or it might be a number of different things. So you don't want them looking at your stuff, right, for sure. But not every case is going to result in revocation of a license or even suspension of a license. Sometimes they close the case with nothing. Sometimes they give you a warning. Sometimes they give you what's called a censure and reprimand. Different states have different language on it. Those are the low levels of discipline. And sometimes they just close it, and you don't know what happened with it, and you don't care because it's gone. And sometimes in New York State, I have cases that are over 10 years old. I'm not going to wake them up. Let it ride, But good. And these are the outcomes I was mentioned about. And sometimes they can be very creative. They can put a doc or PA on probation. They can put them, they can fine them. New York State, it's up to $10,000 per finding of misconduct. That can get expensive if it's, involves a large number of patients and so on. You can be suspended for an actual suspension, rather, or versus a delayed or suspended period of time. A lot of different things can do. But they can come up with anything. They could send a doc or a PA to be evaluated for psychiatric or medical reasons. They can have them go for a clinical competency exam. They can make up the stuff. It's really a kangaroo court. So it's not like the regular stuff. Back to malpractice.
So now you're probably thinking, all right, how do I avoid all this stuff? So this is actual data from malpractice claims against dermatologists and dermatology practitioners. So they looked at from 1991 to 2015, around 90,000 claims were filed total for all comers. 1,084 were against dermatologists. So we're in a specialty where it's not that likely you're going to get sued compared to other specialties. 70% were against male dermatologists, just looking at the room. You guys are already less likely for the most part. 50% were solo practice, and only 3% were institutions, and there's a number of reasons why that probably is, but solo practice was more likely. 68% of claims were abandoned, withdrawn, or dismissed. Why is that important? If you get a board complaint, which happens, if you were to get a claim against you, that does not mean you did something wrong. And there's an emotional reaction that happens when you receive that paperwork. And I always say, for the first 24 hours, put the paper in a drawer and don't look at it and don't do anything about it. Don't talk about it to someone. Don't text someone about it. Put it in a drawer for 24 hours and do absolutely nothing, because the first 24 hours, you will make tons of mistakes that someone like Tom will have to go back and try to mitigate for you, because there's an emotional reaction that happens and you're gonna get it wrong. It's like telling a patient they have cancer. Anything you say after that, they're not gonna do things in a rational, emotionless way. So you put it in the drawer for 24 hours. Most common patient complaint that resulted in a claim was dyschromia. So people think if I miss a melanoma, something bad will happen to me. But dyschromia, like, okay, brown spots, like, what? No, that was actually the most common reason. So 305 claims were related to a procedure out of the 1,000 or so, and about a third of those were paid. 192 claims were related to a misdiagnosis, and again, around a third were paid. Okay, so again, just because someone files a claim doesn't mean that it's actually gonna get paid, because a lot of them could get abandoned, things like that. If you go to trial, which is fairly rare, that favors defendants, which is us, by a factor of 7. Juries tend to be sympathetic towards practitioners unless they feel like you really went beyond the pale in some way. The average recovery per claim was $238,000, and this is obviously the last data point was from 2005. So here is the table that just shows you the different reasons from this study that people got sued. Improper performance of procedures and errors in diagnoses are the two most common reasons people get sued. So that means when you're doing these things, that you should have that in your mind. Improper performance of procedure, like maybe the wrong site or something like that, or error in diagnosis. And when I say error in diagnosis, I don't mean that you thought it was eczema for a year and it turned out to be scabies. I mean, you said it was eczema for a year and never wrote a differential and never considered anything else, and you gave them Kenalog every 2 months, and then it turned out they had bugs in their skin. Trust me, that person is very upset that they spent a year of their life being itchy, getting systemic steroids, when really you never wrote a differential diagnosis. So I'm not suggesting that every SK needs a differential diagnosis. I am suggesting if you're seeing someone for a chronic condition, and you're seeing them back multiple times, and maybe they're not responding to therapy, make sure when someone looks at your notes, they know you thought about other things, and then clinically you felt whatever you felt was most likely. Don't just click a box in EMMA and click the dermatitis NOS box for a year. That is very problematic. So make sure you're writing differentials, because misdiagnoses are the number two reason people get claims against them in the world of dermatology. So here are some preventative things that I've seen being a medical expert that I think are helpful to remember. Everybody knows the first one, right? Everybody hears this first one. Build a rapport with the patients and they'll be less likely to see you. Okay, that's okay to some degree, but if you excise the wrong area of someone's body for a melanoma, it's not gonna matter that you remembered who their grandchildren's birthdays, okay? So yes, it's good to build rapport, but please do not rely on that as some awesome way to prevent some of these things. So one of the big things that I think I see a lot is biases, where someone comes in with a diagnosis and you just accept that diagnosis and never write a differential and never consider other things. That's called anchoring bias. So we all have inherent biases, and I've seen cases where there was literally like 5, 6, 7 practitioners, they all saw the same patient and they all missed the diagnosis. And it's not because they all collectively were bad practitioners, it's because they had certain biases and they were anchoring themselves to diagnoses. Get stuff in writing, because if it's not in writing, it's gonna turn into a he said, she said with Tom one day. And trust me, their wife that was sitting in the room is gonna say, he never said that, and you're gonna say, yes, I did. If it's in writing, they really can't dispute it. And maybe the biggest thing I would say is knowing when to say no. I really like the phrase, just because I can doesn't mean I should. If it's something where you learned how to do it, but you've done it once or twice, you're not super comfortable, but you know you're supposed to be able to do it, that doesn't mean that you should do it if you don't actually feel comfortable and you haven't done it enough to feel comfortable doing it. So just because you can doesn't mean that you should. And I remember the phrase, I could do this for you, but I'm not the best person to do this for you. I could tell, this is something that's very concerning. It's a larger lesion on your face. We've talked about how you're worried about the cosmetic result. I could do this procedure for you, but I think my plastic surgeon friend down the street would do a better job, and I'm gonna refer you to them. They will love you for that. They won't look at you as a bad practitioner for that. They will love you for that. They'll be like, they actually cared enough to recognize they had a limitation, and they're gonna send me to the best person for that. No one can be an expert in everything. So just remember, I'm not the best person to do that for you. When you feel uncomfortable, when you say, this is a little outside what I want to do.
Or, just to, not to interrupt, Mark, but if you don't want to say that this is the best person, he's even more better than I. He's, you know, I would use him. I feel comfortable with him. He's a, you know, he's a great guy. She's a great woman. They're a great, you know, entity to do this and stuff like that. Find a way that you could say it, but tell them why you're doing it. And I think they will respect that, as was said. It really will get you some points, and it's the right thing to do.
I like that phrase. I would send my family member there. Like, they're great. They'll take good care of you. Okay, so another quote from my dad. In my business, guns don't kill, the mouth kills. Guns don't kill, the mouth kills. Whatever you put in writing, whatever you text the person, whatever you say to someone else, like a colleague, just be prepared to have that show up in court documents. So just in your daily life, if you're putting something in writing and you're talking about a legal claim or a case, there is a very good chance it will show up in court documents. So in my business, guns don't kill, the mouth kills. So what are my rules for that? Don't do anything for 24 hours. Don't reply verbally in writing. Don't discuss the claim with anyone. Your instinct is going to be, oh, let me ask my other colleagues in the office. Let me talk to my supervising doctor. Let me ask my husband what he thinks, or my wife what she thinks. No. The guns don't kill, the mouth kills. After the 24 hours, you contact an attorney. I love to hear Tom's opinion on this. I advocate for contacting an attorney outside of your malpractice first, who's an expert in malpractice, and get their opinion and get their guidance for your individual state, what the next steps are and what you should do. And if they say you should be contacting your malpractice, fair enough. But there are times where they may be able to mitigate things for you in a much more effective way that doesn't have to involve the malpractice if it's not a scenario where they want to do that. So I think it's good to just get a legal opinion from someone you trust that's a malpractice attorney, that you get yourself and pay a little bit of money to do that. I think it's a very good way to start the process rolling. So you have someone who's just purely in your corner that's going to advise you on the correct next steps. But if you remember nothing else, don't talk about your claim.
Yeah, so I agree with that. I know a lot of people aren't going to do that because people don't want to reach into that wallet and pull out their card or their checkbook or something like that and pay for that. But it might be the best thing, and it might save you the most in the long haul. You got to watch with medical malpractice insurance companies. There's a lot of great companies out there. Some of them are different than others. And sometimes they want to use one attorney to represent multiple providers in a practice. And invariably, I'm going to look at that and say, there's a conflict of interest here. Mm-hmm. They're not going to look at it that way. And the attorney himself, herself, their self should be looking at it and say, hey, could I get in trouble for this myself? Because there is a conflict. They don't always do that, but you really got to look out for yourself. So I think getting an impartial opinion on somebody who knows medical malpractice defense and also understands the other things is a real, real good idea. It's you've invested so much in your career to get to where you are today. You know, you want to protect that. And again, it's not just about the money, and you don't want to look back and say, oh man, you know, for what it would have cost me, I would have known, and I would have been much more ready for the situation as it came on.
Yeah, those are the two issues I think that come up that I've seen why I recommend this is sometimes there's just a clear conflict where they're representing like the office and you, or other doctors or other providers and you, which is a conflict. And I've seen multiple cases that got settled before it ever went to a malpractice carrier for a very reasonable, agreeable settlement where nothing was ever filed. It was like the lawyer just sent like an intention to file a lawsuit, and because you got the right person involved on your side, it went away like really quickly. So I always advocate, it's worth a little bit of money, I think, to do that. That's what I would personally do.
And it really does work too, because sometimes they think they got the case of the year, and if you've been keeping good records, like you know that you should, and they get those records and a letter back from somebody, and all of a sudden it's like they're not going to do that, because as Mark mentioned earlier, it's very expensive and it's very time consuming to bring a medical malpractice claim. And in case you're not sure what contingency means, it means they don't get paid unless, you know, there's a win, meaning a payout or a jury verdict or something like that. So they don't want to spend next 7 years or 2 or 3 years even and get nothing out of it and have spent well over $100,000 bringing that claim. It's not worth it. It's bad business. It's not a working business model, right? So they want to be really, really careful. So if they get those records and it puts doubt in their mind, They're going to pass it off. And it may be somebody somewhere who's being funded by somebody and will bring a case, but they're not going to win, you know. So it's something to just keep in mind.
Should we keep going?
Yeah. Okay. So as Mark said more than a couple of times now, keep your mouth shut, right?
By the way, Tom wrote these before he saw my stuff, so we both are saying some of this.
Yeah, there's a little bit of overlap, but we're saying it for similar reasons, but slightly different reasons. Don't talk to anybody. And not just, you know, I guess you can tell your spouse, significant other, whatever, you can, but they're going to have more questions, and they're going to work you up and stuff like that. You're not going to have any of those answers yet, so you may be better off avoiding that for another day or two, whatever. But talking to your coworkers and stuff like that, again, is not necessarily a good strategy. They may not know. They may know, because lawsuits are kind of public, right? They're filed through the court system. Anybody can go down there and they can read all these legal paperwork proceedings and so on. Not so with a license investigation. That's all confidential. But you don't want to talk to anybody. You don't want to talk to the media. You know, the local News 1, News 12, News whatever shows up with their van in front of your workplace because one of the people that you were working with was busted selling prescriptions down at the high school for narcotics or ADHD meds or whatever else it might be. You want to be careful. But you don't speak to somebody who calls in, investigators or the lawyers. You're not equipped. Your training is in a different area. We should have asked this, but are there any lawyers in the room? No? Okay, good. All right, so that being the case, if there aren't, well, you don't want to admit, your training is something different, and your experience is something different, so you're not as well equipped to handle those kinds of things. And something that you could say, as Mark said, could be really kind of permanently damaging and so on. So you want to be careful. You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. So the words that you say, or God forbid write, make things even more challenging and so on. So just back one slide, Will.
Oh, sorry.
One more. Okay, so again, once this does happen, obtaining competent healthcare counsel is a priority. It doesn't have to be, this is not a commercial, but you want to get somebody who knows what they're talking about, who really does understand the difference between the different kind of specialties that you could have referred to or the kind of equipment they're using and stuff like that. It's really, really important that they not be, you know, low-level people. And again, watching out for conflicts of interest is really important. Next slide. Sorry, go back one slide,
oh,
Will.
Sorry.
If you want my contact information, you can scan with your phone while Will is, Mark is speaking.
Okay, and then, so I had some do's and don'ts, some things I've gleaned over doing this, and I would love to hear Tom's opinions, and if you disagree, that's completely fine, but I actually like having a little bit of debate over some of these things, but these are some of the things, that, the do's and the don'ts that I've found when I've been asked to be a medical expert, stuff that I wish I could have told the person ahead of time to do. So we'll see how these resonate. So yes, do build rapport. I ask about prior experiences with other practitioners. Nobody ever does that. Hey, I changed practices. Why'd you do that? Did you move to a new city? Or was it someone else down the street and you hated the fact that they examined your breasts? Like, I want to know that before I examine you. So tell me what you didn't like about why you switched, you know, over, because there might be something that you need to know before you actually talk to that patient. The other thing I think is so important is know when it needs to be you. So many times the patient calls the office and they get that like annoying phone tree of people that isn't the actual person that would end up receiving a legal claim. So I train my staff to know when it needs to be me. If the person is upset, if they've had a complication, if there's anything more than just tier one support, I would rather be 10 minutes late to the next patient and address that person in real time than make them feel like I don't care or it's not important to me or whatever. No one ever got sued for running late, but you do get sued more frequently and by not building rapport. And one of the ways you build rapport is by showing the people when they have a serious concern that you're meeting them where they are and that you also share that concern for them. So I think that's critical, is know when it needs to be you. Get on the phone yourself and talk to people. We talked about this one, get informed consent. I put some of the typical things where I've seen people run into trouble where they didn't specifically consent to things. So I put those up there for your reference. Remember to formulate a differential diagnosis, avoid anchoring bias. So I write atopic dermatitis, parentheses, versus less likely, you know, CTCL, less likely scabies, you know, no bathing suit involvement, no webbing of the hands involvement. Put why you thought that. Even if you're wrong, that doesn't mean it's malpractice, but it is a deviation from the standard of care to see someone for a year and never write a differential on something. Then if you miss something that was important, someone's gonna come back and say, hey, you treated them for a year, you never even wrote anything other than dermatitis, and it never responded to any of the therapies. Now you didn't formulate a differential diagnosis. This is maybe the most important thing, I think. When it comes to that red light in the back of your mind, push pause. Stop what you're doing. We all want to give someone a diagnosis that day, right? In dermatology, you walk in the room, you walk out with a diagnosis. That's acne, that's rosacea, et cetera. Sometimes that's not possible. If someone comes in with a stack full of medical records and you have a 10-minute slot, tell the patient, my office put you in a 10-minute slot. I'm not gonna have time to go through all of this records in detail. I wanna take a good history from you and make sure I can examine you. Then I need to go back and digest this when I have time to sit down and go over everything. And I would like you to provide me with any records that I don't have so I have a complete picture. So push pause, tell the patient that. They will love you for that. They will not be mad that you didn't give them a diagnosis. So don't feel rushed. When someone has a crazy story, those are the people that are more likely to cause you problems later. Push pause, tell the patient you're pushing pause, and collect information, look at that information when it's calm after the hecticness of a visit. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it raises so many good points, but just being smart and doing it the right way and reaching out to other providers, sometimes you will hear very interesting things. And when you find out it wasn't one other practice, it was seven other practices they've been to in the last year or even 7 years, you got to wonder why. There's more to the story than you know what they're leading you to believe.
I try to anticipate problems. Some of the big ones I see are missing an allergy. You know, you prescribe someone penicillin who has a clear penicillin allergy on the chart, it is very difficult to defend that if they actually had a legitimate allergic reaction from penicillin. So make sure when you're prescribing or if there's certain things about a patient's chart, like medications and allergies are the two biggest ones, make sure that you see that. And I advocate for photos for all biopsy sites. That way you don't lose the site when you're referring to somebody else. So 89% of Mohs surgeons reported a photograph as the best form of documentation. 88% reported the majority of the referrals do not have a photograph. So they all want them, and 88% of the time they don't get them. So just take a photo. It doesn't need to be a close-up photo. I just want one far away so you can see where this thing was. So there's no dispute later, and you can say, I pointed to the photograph, the person confirmed that that's what they wanted. That's just a timeout. Over-communicate procedures. If you're gonna do that to someone, they should know that that's what you're doing to them, and I show them a photo and say, this is gonna be a significant procedure for you. I wanna show you what this looks like so that you're not concerned after the procedure that this is unexpected, okay? Like, people take the dressings down and they see that, and they freak out, and they go to a plastic surgeon, like, what do they do to you? They butcher you, and they didn't know what the whole planned procedure was. So make sure they know what you're gonna do. Know the laws in your state. Tom mentioned it, but a lot of these things are state specific. So you need to know what your state laws are so you can adhere to them. Don't document something you don't do something about. Don't document 7-millimeter irregularly shaped dark black macule on the back, you know, we'll monitor, okay? Don't take a photo of something that you're not biopsying because someone can go back later and say, that looked like a clear melanoma to me. And in hindsight, it was a melanoma, but You took photographic evidence of the fact that it was there, but then didn't do anything about it. So I love photos for biopsies. I hate photos for stuff you're not doing something about. And if you're gonna take a photo of something you're not doing something about, give an extra data point that can't be argued. Like, on dermoscopy, it had normal, benign appearing features. Now, no one can argue that. I can't go back and look at your grainy Emma photo and say, oh, that looked like a melanoma. No, she said it was normal on dermoscopy, under the light, under magnification. So add a data point. I definitely recommend not texting with patients. If they need to text a photo or something, that's fine, but don't text back with patients. Call them and then document the discussion from your perspective. Otherwise, there's a clear written out text message string back and forth, and if it turns out you did do something wrong, it is clearly written out what you did and what you didn't do. Document from your perspective, but don't text with people.
Right, and what's worse is that that's not being kept as part of the medical record. So it's a medical record violation. It's a HIPAA violation potentially and some other things. So bad idea to text, absolutely.
don't alter the medical record. I think this is probably one that bothers you a lot. But I've seen cases where it's like, informed consent, I told the patient for this excision they could have damage to the nerves, including the branch of the ulnar nerve. Oh, wow, what a coincidence. That was the one that was actually people write stuff like that because they want to cover themselves after the fact. Like, oh, saying nerve damage and my consent wasn't good enough. I need to, like, jot in the actual nerve that could have been. Stuff like that, there's such a temptation during that emotional time when you receive the record. Don't talk, but also don't put stuff in writing and don't attempt to alter the medical record. You can put addendums. Do not alter the medical record. It's very obvious, even to a non-medical person, that the record has been altered. And use your own words. I'm fine with templates, but for things that are more complicated, please put your own differential in your own words. I know the trend now is just to click an assessment and plan button in like the Emmas of the world, but it gets you in a lot of trouble when someone actually looks back at the medical record and there's nothing useful in there. It helps you so much more just say what you were thinking at the time, because most of the time you have very reasonable thoughts and your differentials are fine. You just never wrote anything. You just clicked a button in Emma because you were going fast. So do things in your own words. We talked about what the standard of care means. Think about what would the average practitioner do in similar circumstances. And if you want to know that, query your practitioners in your area and your local site. Hey, I have this case. You know, what do you think? And I like to document that in my note. Hey, I spoke to two other dermatologists in my area. They agree that this is the right thing to do for a weird, interesting case. It's not the bread and butter thing. What a great way to establish the standard of care. You said I spoke to some other practitioners in my area. So, and lastly, don't be in a rush. So with that, I think we have a few minutes here for questions. Thank you so much for having us today. Hopefully this wasn't scary, hopefully it was informative, and we're happy to take a few questions if there are some.
No, thank you very much, that was very informative. And we do have three questions that were put into the app. The first one is, how do you vet a good medical malpractice lawyer? How do you vet?
What's the NPDB of malpractice lawyers?
Yeah, they don't have one of those, of course. Why? Because the laws are made by lawyers, right? So all joking aside, there is a lot of work that has to be done, but you can do it. You can find out reputations. I don't know that necessarily the reviews that you see online for businesses is going to help you as much as reputation amongst different law firms and so on. So you could try to find out about that, but you definitely want to do that. And
if you don't like the attorney it's assigned by the malpractice insurance, can you request a different attorney?
Great question. So the answer to that is it depends on your insurance company. They may say, no, we got a contract. They're a participating provider in this area. That's the only lawyer that we have for 500 miles. You're stuck with him, her, them. Right? Or they may say, no, it's up to you. I like the insurance companies that give you the choice in who you select. You can pick any lawyer you want. It could be your cousin, who's a terrible healthcare attorney, but a halfway decent real estate attorney, but they got a law degree and they can do it. And, you know, that leaves you in a bad spot, but it's your own doing. But if you do ask around, you can find you can get good recommendations of people's reputation and abilities and so on, but it's not an easy thing to do. But you absolutely should ask your insurance company, hey, who else you got if there is a problem, because we're not communicating well or something like that.
And I think it's good to look at their work experience sometimes too, because some attorneys will actually have worked for the entity that is interested in you. Like some attorneys have worked for various regulatory bodies and then they came over to the private sector. So it's good to see what their work experience was before they were at their current position.
Right, very much like a criminal defense attorney who used to be a prosecutor. Right, you get how that would be beneficial potentially, and so on. But yeah, I think you can ask those questions, and you're all polite, professional people. If they're offended by that question, then you got to wonder what's going on with that. You can ask me questions. I don't know if I can answer. How many cases have you done? I have no idea. I don't care how many I did. Give me a time frame, you know, or something like that. But I could tell you I've done, you know, 10 cases of these, 15 cases of those, probably 120 of those or whatever. And if that's not good enough, then I don't know what is. But I think it is a good, fair question. Next one.
All right. And we've had a flood of questions, so I'm going to try to pick out the ones that are that came in first. But advice of a coworker or even a supervising doc seems to be stretching the legal limit, like they're doing excessive or medically unnecessary procedures. Am I in danger because I work there?
Well, you're saying the supervising physician is encouraging this person to do things that they feel are gray or excessive in some way?
It seems like the question could be that, or include that they're just part of the practice, but the supervising physician is stretching the legal limit. Are they in danger because they work in the same practice?
I mean, I'll give you my medical opinion on that, which is you're responsible for your own license, and you're not responsible for someone else, what someone else is doing with their license. Nothing is more important than your ability to practice and your license. So if you're being asked to do things under your license that you feel are not appropriate, then you should refuse to do those things or find a different practice if they're forcing you to do those things. If the practice is doing them as a whole and it's not under your license, like some other practitioner is doing things in an inappropriate way, that's probably a harder discussion to have of whether or not you want to be a part of that practice. But first and foremost, you need to think about, this is my license, and whatever I'm doing, I have to be willing to defend that what I'm doing is within the standard of care.
Right. So I would just add to that that you don't want to be in an environment where they're doing bad medicine or excessive, you know, treatment or procedures and so on. But by the same token, in some states like New York, if a PA or a doc physician knows that somebody else is committing misconduct, if they do not report him, her, them, then it's misconduct on their part. So you want to be really, really careful. So yes, you have an obligation to report that. That's not every state. Find out what your state requires, and if you're not sure, give me a call. We'll talk about it.
If the practice is doing certain procedures or something that you're not comfortable with, and occasionally or whatever, you're being asked to supervise or do those procedures, you need to speak up for yourself and say, I'm not comfortable doing that. I don't think it's appropriate. If there's a difference in philosophies with this practice, then it's maybe not the right practice for me.
Absolutely.
I think we have 1 minute. So a failure of a patient to follow up or go see a specialist if I refer them to that specialist or I schedule them to have a growth excise and they decide it's too much money and cancel. I think they're asking, you know, what's the risk in that?
Okay, from the medical side, I have a clear answer to this, which is the patient, if they're an adult and they can make their own decisions, you need to make sure that you document that you've informed them of the risks and benefits of the procedure you're recommending and the risks of not having that procedure done. So, for example, if someone has a bad-looking mole and you're like, I want to biopsy it, and they're like, well, I got a wedding, I don't want to biopsy it, I'll come back, and I document in my notes, I inform the patient that I'm concerned this could be a melanoma, which can result in, you know, metastasis, even death, et cetera, and waiting more than X period of time would increase the risks of that. Now they're an adult and they have to be responsible for their own healthcare, but you don't want someone coming back to you and saying, they never informed me that this mole could turn into a stage 4 metastatic melanoma and kill me. I would never have waited a year. I just thought it was a mole. Moles aren't a big deal. So you want to make sure you document that you inform the patient of the risks of the negative, of not doing something.
Okay, and I would add to that, yes, kinda, but I think you still have exposure. So if they're not going, even if you're perfectly informing them of the risks of non-compliance with that treatment plan, or whether it's a referral or treatment or a diagnostic study or whatever it might be, quite frankly, if they don't go and get that done, you're liable. I have to say you're liable. And what's happened in more than one state is that there's been a finding of misconduct. So it quite frankly requires you to do something sometimes drastic, including terminating the relationship with the patient, because you're going to be exposed. Yes, they're an adult. Yes, they have the ability to make a decision. Yes, they have to take care of themselves, but it's still going to fall back on you. So I would always tell somebody, please don't put yourself in that position.
And I would just remind you, because I was a pediatrician first, kids, none of that, all that goes out the window. If you have to advocate for a child because you think the parent is not making a medically sound decision, like we've had to call people because they didn't want to give their kid antibiotics and they were dying of diphtheria. If it's a child and you feel like you need to advocate, then you're mandated to do that.
Right, a whole different suggestion. Yes?
The question being is, would a certified letter be along the same lines of being able to kind of cover your tracks?
Yeah, I mean, Tom, there's a certain amount of people
so,
that are just going to fall
so
off
the question was, if sending a certified letter to the patient, would that make it better, be helpful and stuff? Yes, it would. I would send it certified return receipt, whatever you call it in your state. I would send it FedEx or some other, you know, carrier or whatever, but it still doesn't fix the problem. You could tell them 4,000 times they're gonna say and do something else like that, and it puts you at risk. And I would tell anybody that patient noncompliance is a huge problem, and you need to deal with it appropriately and effectively. And you can't paper your way out of that. You just can't do it. No matter how well you do it, and it's a great suggestion to send a certified mail, it's not enough sometimes to protect yourself.
Thank you all so much. This was very informative, and we really appreciate your insights.
Thank you very much.